Welcome to Mortified, the Friendship Quest, a podcast where two long-distance friends bounce media recommendations all in hopes the other will like it. I'm Aaron.
And I'm just, like, really good at particle effects.
And this week, we celebrate the heyday of Tumblr's hottest icons with Rise of the Guardians and The Lorax. Before I shame Layla for their taste in men, remember you can help us on Mortify the Legitimacy Quest by subscribing to us on YouTube, iTunes, or Spotify, or following us on Tumblr at Mortified Pod. Layla.
Aaron.
Happy Easter, and more importantly, happy Trans Day of Visibility.
Thank you. Happy Easter and happy Trans Day of Visibility to you and all who celebrate, which should be everyone.
Yippee. We are, to celebrate these two momentous occasions, doing perhaps the least homosexual thing, which is taking a deep dive into what teen girls on Tumblr were into in 2012. We're basically, this is just like an Easter thing, right? Because the Easter Bunny's in one of these movies.
Yeah, that's where it started. And then we thought about it for 10 seconds and we said, what if we also watched The Lorax?
Yeah, you know, we talked about this on our Tumblr Sexy Man episode, but I was just like morbidly curious to see, you know, why, you know, what happened in this movie. And I was very disappointed. We'll talk about it. But yeah, there's a reason you don't really adapt Dr. Seuss novels into full length movies anymore.
God, they also did Cat in the Hat. Do you remember that?
I remember I want to say Jim Carrey Cat in the Hat.
I want to say it's Jim Carrey also.
The live action
Cat in the Hat.
Yeah, that was weird. And, I don't know.
Oh, and the elephant. He's not an elephant.
Horton. Yeah, he is an
Horton.
Elephant.
Horton, here's who.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are the three that they tried.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't know that any of those are necessary. We'll talk about it. But yeah.
I was gonna say, can we start with The Lorax so we end high?
Yes, that's a good idea. Do you want to do that or do you want me to do that?
I will do it because I want to hear your opinions on what little happens in this flick.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So in The Lorax, it opens with The Lorax himself and his glorious blonde mustache addressing the audience and saying that he's about to tell you a story, which is very funny because the container of the story The Lorax is telling is the Onceler telling the story to Ted. Mm-hmm. So it is a story within a story within a story.
Right.
So we are introduced in Thneedville. It is a city where everything is plastic. The trees are plastic and inflatable. The water will turn your kids glowing and radioactive. And you have to buy fresh air from Mr. O'Hare. Mr. O'Hare, who looks like Edna Mode.
He really does.
Yeah. Cunty little Bob, tiny little man, two giant henchmen. Love to see it. Ted, our protagonist, is a teenage boy. He is in love with a teenage girl named Audrey, played by Taylor Swift.
Yeah, I did not realize that until I looked it up 5 minutes ago.
I just, like, clocked it in the credits. All right. Sure.
I mean, to be fair, you know, Ted is played by Zac Efron, right? This is happening in, like, 2012, right? That's when this movie came out. So, it makes sense, right?
I was stunned by seeing Zefron in the opening credits. Mm-hmm. Lorax played by Danny DeVito.
Danny DeVito,
also.
Yes, yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. Stunt. Well, the other movie has a stunt cast too, but I mean, they're incredible, and I think almost all of them have a history in animation voice acting in some way or another. Mm-hmm. So Ted, our protagonist, is in love with Audrey, who wants anything, nothing more than to see a real tree. She just wants to see a real tree growing out of the ground. And Ted, being horny and a teenager, is like, girl, what would happen if, like, I don't know, like a guy brought you like a tree? And mm-hmm. Audrey's like, oh, I'd marry him on the spot. And for mm-hmm. Ted, this is enough. And he says, got it, clocked, I'll be back. Mm-hmm. Ted goes home where he lives with his grandmother and his mother and says, hey, grandma, if a guy wanted to like find a tree, where would one go? And his mom says, why would you want to find a real tree? They're dirty, nasty, stinky, mm-hmm. gross. Our tree lights up in different seasons and also disco.
Yeah, no, listen, I think the story is nothing, but there's some pretty good jokes in here. And it's like, yeah, we've got summer, fall, winter, and disco. And later on, when she's driving her car, she has a little disco ball in her rear view. That's a very funny, like a cute gag about how her mom, Ted's mom, is just like a weird disco fan.
I know, she's great. for that reason. But she's not as good as my favorite character in the whole fucking movie, Grammy.
Mm-hmm.
Grammy for an Oscar. Grammy does everything here. Grammy fucking rules. So Grammy is like, oh no, I forgot my teeth in the other room, and gets mom to go away.
Mm-hmm.
And then gives Ted the most melodramatic recounting of where one could go to find the one slur. And basically she's like, you gotta bring a nail, the shell of a great-great-grandfather snail, and some third thing I'm blanking on.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'll tell you the story of what happened to the trees.
Mm-hmm.
But he lives outside of town, and to find him, you have to go where the air is, like, really, really stinky.
Mm-hmm.
And Ted is like, okay, I want this girl bad enough. Fuck it up, let's go.
Right.
So he finds the button to the door. Another great sight gag. He pushes a button and the door is like halfway up this great giant wall that is surrounding the city. And the button makes stairs come out of the wall. Like,
yeah.
That's fun.
Yeah, that's good fun. Yeah.
And he goes outside of town to find this dirty, nasty, stinky, tall house where the Onceler lives. Now, this is not the Onceler flat-ass twink that everyone is picturing right now. I need you to wipe that away. This Onceler is old. He is haggard.
I was shocked when I saw this guy's like, oh, this is a Onceler who has fallen from grace. Nobody on Tumblr would be thirsting over this Onceler.
Oh, I don't know. Don't doubt the girlies.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. They loved a fucking old man.
Yeah, they're in their old man era right now.
Mm-hmm.
The girlies are, which, you know, I'm pro.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so Onceler's like, hey kid, fuck off. Didn't you see this keep out signs? Go fuck yourself.
He has a weirdly elaborate, like, Rube Goldberg defense mechanism where, like, a hammer will come out of the door and try to squash you, and then it, like, launches you into the air, and then, like, a big claw will come in after you, and then after that's done, a boot will shoot out of the wall and kick you in the ass to make you leave. It's pretty good.
If you had to live alone in the wreckage of your ecological destruction for 50 or 60 years, would you not also get into Rube Goldberg machines?
Yeah, no, I would definitely go through a period where it's like, well, I'm living in, like, the remnants, like, the rusting mechanical engines of my own destruction just litter the twisted world around me. I got some time on my hands. I'll make some saw traps. I would do that. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we respect our Rube Goldberg king. So Ted breaks through to the Onceler, and he's like, hey, my dude, I need to know about fucking trees. Can you tell me about trees? And the Onceler is like, bad news about trees. I happened to the trees. And Ted is like, what could you possibly mean by that? So the Onceler, we've now entered the twink zone.
Right.
Right. This is layer three.
Right.
This is Inception. This is it. we're in the juicy center of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So here we see the young Onceler, not yet wearing his green trappings. He's just an average boy.
With a fedora.
with a fedora, saying goodbye to his shitty family, being like, okay, I'm going to go sell my cool, sick, awesome product, the Thneed, and I'm going to be so successful and so rich and so sexy. You know, just you wait and see. I'm going to find the perfect material to make it. And his family's like, okay, loser, go fuck yourself. I won't be surprised at all if you don't fucking make it. Bye.
Mm-hmm.
So the Onceler takes off with his guitar and his donkey named Melvin, another great character in this flick.
Mm-hmm.
Melvin, better performance than, I don't know, half the other kids. The animals were all great, but Melvin especially was a wonderful audience surrogate watching his owner go down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see the Onceler take this journey through river and desert and swamp and whatever, and he finally finds this beautiful forest full of these beautiful, round, soft, fluffy truffula trees.
Right.
And he says, great, this is what I'm going to make my fucking needs out of. Also, they're singing animals here. That fucking rules. I'm going to give them all marshmallows. They're going to love me forever. And then the Onceler proceeds to chop down a truffula tree. And this summons, in an epic storm, the Lorax.
Right.
And the Lorax tracks down good old Oncey. And he says, hey, the fuck are you doing? Can't chop down these fucking trees. You gotta just, this whole movie, the crux of it is Danny DeVito being disappointed in the Onceler.
Right.
So it is effective in that sense. You don't want Danny DeVito to be disappointed.
No, it's hard.
Very hard to hear. And the one, the Lorax is like, hey, dude, we have all got to, like, take care of this forest together. These animals need these trees. You can't do this. You can't cut them down anymore. And they have, like, a bit of tension where the Lorax is, making him promise that he won't cut down any more trees. And he does try
to drown him at one point.
He does try to drown him first, is the thing. He does put his bed in a river, and the only reason the monster doesn't drown is because one of the baby bears gets on the bed with him, and they have to kind of save the Onceler to save the baby bear.
Right. The Onceler is not thrilled when he realizes that the Lorax has tried to drown and kill him.
He is also not thrilled when he wakes up with the Lorax sleeping in his bed and his house full of the animals.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I bet that there's a juicy vein of AO3 material about the Lorax / the Onceler. There's only one bed trope, 50,000 word slow burn. But I do get why the Onceler doesn't like the Lorax. I don't think the Lorax could just go into his house and also bring all the animals there. I don't think that's right. I think the Onceler did nothing wrong, actually.
Okay, interesting take that the Onceler did nothing wrong. So the Onceler is like, fine, I won't chop down any more trees. I got the one that I need. I'm going to make a prototype Thneed.
Mm-hmm.
Unintentional rhyme. I'm going to go into town. I'm going to try to sell it. And even the Lorax is like, my guy, good luck. You're not going to fucking sell shit.
Mm-hmm.
No one is on one C's side here.
They start throwing tomatoes at him throughout. He has like a little song about how everybody needs a Thneed, and like 5 seconds into it, they start like throwing shit at him and like yelling at him. A child takes his guitar and like smashes it on the stairs. The people of what will become Thneedville are terrible.
Yeah, they're not great, and they only get worse because basically they get 1C to a point where he gives up. Mm-hmm. And he goes back to the Lorax in the forest, and he's like, I couldn't sell it. I gave up. I just kind of tossed it aside. The problem is that when he tossed it aside, it landed very fashionably on a woman's head.
Right.
And everybody suddenly was like, oh my God, the potential of the Thneed. He was so right. And then these morons, this sea of mindless consumers, runs into the forest singing, what else? But everybody needs a Thneed.
Yeah, yeah. We haven't talked a whole lot about the music in this movie yet, but of the songs that have happened so far, how have you felt about them? Because I
couldn't hum you a single one.
Me either. The only line that I even remember besides how bad can I be is the Aloysius O'Hare, the man who sold air and became a zillionaire, because that's a completely fine rhyme. But yeah, I don't think the songs really do anything in this movie.
No, not a thing. I don't understand why it had to be a musical.
Mm-hmm.
This is a common complaint here. I'm mortified the Friendship Quest, but this movie tonally, wild. It only gets wilder as
over the place. Yeah, and you know, as we're discussing it more, I am just truly unsure of who the audience was for this.
Yeah. So also, fun little thing. Throughout this story, it takes place over 3 days for Ted. So the Onceler sends him away the first day, and it's like, well, I guess you don't want to hear the rest of the story if you don't want to come back. And Ted is like, no, I want to hear the rest of the story. Obviously. Hello. And when he comes back, and we'll get into this later, we'll put a pin in this. When he comes back, the Onceler immediately hones in on the fact that he's doing this to impress a girl.
Mm-hmm.
Because he could have no other possible motivation to find out about trees other than to impress a girl.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this takes place over the 3 days. And for Ted, this means that O'Hare has like heard that Ted is asking about trees. And what do trees make? Oxygen.
Right.
And what does O'Hare sell? Oxygen. So obviously he feels threatened and is like trying to intimidate Ted into not going outside and like making going outside very hard for him. And just keep that in the back of your head that is happening. Now that 1C, by the way, he is called 1C by people in the movie. So this is not
That's not Layla's special nickname.
No, this is his canonical shortened name. So once he's like, oh shit, I gotta call in some help if I'm gonna make all these needs. So he calls his shitty family. And a shitty family arrives, and the brothers immediately start chucking a little bear around. Like
the first thing they do when they get out of their RV is they pick up a baby bear and throw him like a football. It's really funny.
And he has to go long.
Yeah.
That bear goes flying. Again, great sight gags, nothing story.
Right.
So whatchamacallit? Yeah, they arrive, and they're all terrible people. And Wunsler's, like, in his tent, like, making plans to make a factory, and his mom comes to his window and is like, Wunsie, we got a problem. We're not really harvesting the truffula tufts fast enough. It would be, like, so much easier if we could just cut down the trees. And Wunsler, who is a blatantly evil twink, just is like, well, I promised I wouldn't, though. And she's like, but it doesn't matter. And he closes his blinds and lets his family start chopping down trees.
Right.
And this is where we get into how bad could I be?
Yeah. I did make a gif of that song. I don't know if you saw in my notes.
Oh, you made that. That was a present
just for you.
Thank you so much.
Listen, I took some screenshots that would do numbers in 2012 on Tumblr. I'm bringing that back. I'm just going to be a Wunsler thirst blog. That should be my April Fool's joke on Tumblr.
Yeah, not your very good essay. Instead... this.
Yeah, no. But yeah, no. How bad can I be is I have to say this, a dog shit song. It's nothing.
It's nothing. His outfit sucks.
Yeah, the green gloves and the green hat, he looks like a shitty Riddler.
He looks like a shitty Riddler. And the choreo's fine. The song, I can't even hum you the song. I have no idea what it was.
How about can I be? I'm just sure. Doing what comes naturally.
Like sure. I you know what? I believe you.
Yeah.
yeah, it's something. I love it. But anyway, so he chops down all the fucking trees. And the Lorax comes to him and is like, hey, dude, are you like happy? All the animals have to go on a fucking trail of tears.
It is. I'm glad that you said that because I definitely was getting that like illusion.
That's what it felt like.
It's not great.
Like, it's not great. So all these like sad animals are marching. He tries to offer one of them a marshmallow and it turns him down. And, you know, everything is like where it was beautiful and green and colorful and whatever, you know, Dr. Seuss, like now everything is gray and dusty and nasty.
It looks like a World War I battlefield out there.
It looks
insane. Fucking no man's land.
And the Lorax, and this is what we talk about when we talk about cognitive or fucking tonal dissonance. The Lorax gives him the spiel, leaves this like little monument behind that says unless, and then I'm painting you a word picture, audience.
Excited for Layla to try to explain this.
So, we just got out of How Bad Can I Be? Everything is a wasteland. We are watching the last tree go down in slow motion in a wide shot. Mind you, the first tree that went down got a funeral rite from the Lorax and all the animals. So, like, already the audience is kind of conditioned to the importance of chopping down these trees. Did the funeral rite make me cry? Yes, we don't have to talk about it.
Anyway. I can't.
I like trees. So we watched the last tree go down. This sad, like, think opening of Kingdom Hearts choir is just, like, painting the tone in the background of this desolation while the Lorax is, like, standing there and is like, are you happy? Did this fill the hole inside of you? Because that's it. No more trees, motherfucker. Like, nothing. You have nothing left. You can't sell any more needs because you have no supplies to make it. The animals are doing a trail of tears out of here. Like, are you happy? And the Wunsler is not happy and is surprised that he's not happy. And then the Lorax standing on this little stone monument, coral, beautiful. Everything is purple, dark. It's fucking desolate. Mood painting. The Lorax picks his own ass up and wedges himself into a god ray coming from between the clouds. And it is the most unserious I've ever seen in my life, as a beautiful choir of sad children is painting a total picture of the background.
Oh, Layla can't see this because my camera's off, but I am crying. It's such a choice.
It's so many choices.
Why did they do that?
Okay. Breathing.
We're fine.
Breathing.
You should look this up. It's indescribable what happens.
I tried my best, but truly nothing can do it justice. You just have to go see what happens immediately after How Bad Can I Be? Whew. Okay. We go back to, we're out of the third layer, back into the second layer, we're in the Ted layer. We're out of the Twink zone, into the Ted zone. And the Onceler is like, hey dude, I've been waiting for somebody like you to come along, which I have a problem with this plot point. And he was like, I have the last Truffula seed. You need to go plant it in the center of town and show everybody what a tree can be. Because it's that quote from the Lorax, unless someone like you cares a lot.
A whole awful lot. It's nothing is going to get better. It's not.
Thank you. So it's that thing, right? That's the unless monument. So he sends him down with the Truffula seed, and he's like, go home, plant the seed. Except at this point, O'Hare is on Ted's case. And O'Hare, when Ted goes to get Aubrey, and he's like, hey, I need you to meet me at my house. Don't ask any questions, just come to my house. And she's like, I guess. And he goes home where O'Hare is intimidating his mom with his thugs.
Right.
And he tells mom to go get him a cookie, which is a very funny distraction, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hey, Miss Ma'am, I want a cookie. Can you go get me one? And then his thugs block her out from the living room. And he's like, I know you have it. And Ted is like, have what? I have no idea what you're talking about. And O'Hare's like, the fucking seed. What are we doing here? And then O'Hare proceeds to unlawfully ransack this boy's room.
Yeah, he just like goes into this teen boy's bedroom. It's very strange.
It's bizarre. Mom kicks him out. Mom's like, this is unacceptable. Get the fuck out of here. And she turns to Ted. She's like, you have to tell me what's going on. He's like, hey, the seed should be in here. I don't see it. She's like, what do you mean? He's like, tree seed, Truffula tree. And they have this whole conversation about trees being stinky and smelly. He's like, no, they make air. They're good. We should plant this. Mm-hmm. And she goes, fine. Aubrey gets there. And then who has the seed but grandma, who fucking rules?
Yeah, she kicks ass.
Then we proceed to have a high octane speed chase where mom distracts the goons while Ted takes Grandma and Audrey on his little, like, crotch rocket, and they take off to go to the center of town.
Right.
Through this, Grandma at one point gets separated and has to snowboard.
Yeah, it's sick. The Grandma snowboarding sequence owns. And even Audrey's like, your Grandma's the coolest person in the world, which is really fun.
And Taylor Swift is right.
100%.
So they get to the center of town, and then it's like the longest ending sequence in the world. Then we do some eco-terrorism. Mm-hmm. There's a bulldozer involved. There's a golden statue of O'Hare that gets kind of dismembered. And they have this whole thing. And O'Hare is like, oh my God, well, do you guys really want like stinky, smelly trees, townspeople? They're sticky and smelly and they explode sap everywhere. Ooh, nasty. And he's like, hey, you, dancing delivery man from the opening sequence who served, tell them. And I think his name is Cal, the dancing delivery man, or Dan or something. I don't remember. Yeah. Three letters.
Right.
He starts singing a solo for a song called Let It Grow.
Right.
Which is dangerously close to Let It Go, I've realized.
This predates Let It Go, to be fair.
Well, DreamWorks, time to lawyer.
Yeah, seriously.
So they sing this, it's giving Beatles.
Oh, Let It Be is what you're thinking, okay.
Yeah, but the kind of vibe of it was giving me Beatles a little bit.
I mean, it is a little bit like, you know, Kumbaya Hare Krishna sort of shit, but I guess.
Yeah. You you know, it was that. So they sing this big Kumbaya song, and they try to do the thing where, like, the villain joins in, but it's a fake out, and he's like, I think we should let it die, and nobody finds it.
Yeah, that part sucks, but it's whatever.
Yeah, so they plant the seeds, and, you know, for the first truffula tree, and then we go to Mr. Old Onceler, the Oldsler. Mm-hmm. And there are little truffula tree saplings all around, and he walks outside for the first time. And, mind you, still wearing a thneed, which is a choice. Starts watering all the truffula saplings. And then a god ray comes from the fucking sky, mm-hmm. and who floats down by the power of his own ass? But the Lorax.
He's back.
And the two old men embrace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the end of the movie.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it ends with Old Man Yowie. It's awesome.
Yeah, so... Whew! That was a lot of movie where not a lot happened. And the characters were paper thin because it's based on a book
for
babies written by Dr. Seuss.
Right, a literal children's picture book. Yeah, like... You brought this up in your notes, but, like, this is the other side of the coin of, like, oh, we have to make everything a sequel or a reboot. This is, like, oh, well, what if we take some like, an established property that is nothing and blow it up into something that's maybe something? And, like, you know, this is Illumination, right? This is Illumination in 2012, so they are, like, writing that. They're about to hit peak Minions. They are ramping into the you know, their... They're notorious mascots. The Minions even like make a brief appearance in the like opening like credits of the movie. So like yeah, they're like
post.
Because I want to say Despicable Me was 2010.
Despicable Me,
right?
Yeah. So it's post Despicable Me, but pre Minions.
Right. Like they haven't like hit the pipeline, the baby Yoda pipeline, where it's like let's just throw everything into like these cute little guys that are kind of plushy and fun or whatever. And yeah, like, you know, I think that this is kind of like an omen of things to come, right? Like the ways in which, you know, corporations will latch onto IP that don't really need to be expanded on. This is like the first graspings of that, as well as like the like weaponization of fandom that is going to start really, you know, it has been happening. But like because the internet is like really starting to hit its stride here in 2012. Like, that's when we're going to start seeing, you know, like, people, like, start, you know, catering to internet fandoms. Like, you know, this is, like, 2 years out from Gamergate when we start getting, like, big online movements and stuff. So, like, I think this movie does, like, represent, like, the inklings of a lot of stuff that's going to come to define the early 2010s. But it's such a strange way to see it in this movie that's really nothing.
Yeah, it's that meme, that domino meme.
Right, this is one of the dominoes.
The Lorax is like one of the bottom dominoes, mm-hmm. and then Morbius coming back into theaters is the big one.
Yeah, like 100%, unfortunately. Yeah, just a wild movie. I'm glad I watched it. You know, I'm glad that you gave me the opportunity to watch the little Onceler shaking his cardboard angled ass.
Flat ass.
I don't know. I mean, God. Girls on Tumblr in 2013 must have been so fucking starved for any sex appeal at all that they latched onto this. Like, it's very sad.
The Benedict Cumberbatch to Onceler pipeline, I think, is probably very real.
Yeah, no. You just hate to see it.
Yeah. Not that, listen, Benedict Cumberbatch, I don't want to be mean about the man's appearance, but I'm just saying a disproportionate amount of teen girls were horny for that 38-year-old man, myself included. So, like, you know, I'll say the taste for, like, underappreciated or unconventional hotties mm-hmm. was really brewing on that website early on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Shall we talk about another movie that came out in, I believe, 2012? That mm-hmm. was a little bit better, IMO.
Fun fact, I stopped watching the Oscars because of this movie.
you stopped watching the Oscars because it was on, or because you thought it was snubbed?
I thought it was snubbed. Brave took the award this year.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have seen Brave.
A completely fine movie that was completely mismarketed.
Yeah, Brave was, much more about motherhood, I believe. And then they were, like, trying to make it about, like, shooting arrows and shit.
Yeah, because the trailer was very much, if you could change your destiny, would you?
Yeah.
And then I went in to see a beautiful mother-daughter tale. But when you're not expecting a beautiful mother-daughter tale and you're there for a girl adventure,
right?
You come out a little disappointed. But then afterwards, I thought about it. I was like, it was a really good movie. It's not what I wanted or what I was expecting at the time. So
right.
But I also didn't think it was Disney's or Pixar's best movie.
No.
But I thought this was so, I don't know, I thought this was so, like, fun and promising and, like, new and like a fun take on something. And it was done really beautifully. And I don't think I like it as much. Well, I see the flaws in it more now as an adult than I did when I was just, like, just leaving high school and entering film school.
Right.
But I still think it's a really great movie. I would, like, gladly sit my nephews down in front of it, I am still mad it was snubbed. I thought it was really good. DreamWorks rules.
Fair enough. Let's talk about Rise of the Guardians. So,
the Avengers could fucking never.
Yeah, I mean, it is wild that this comes out the same year that the Avengers comes out. Man, 2012, really pivotal year for American culture.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so Rise of the Guardians. We get the birth of Jack Frost, who is a barefoot, white-haired young man voiced by Chris Pine. He has the powers of ice. The first thing we get is him, like, bursting out of this, like, frozen lake and looking up at the moon. Darkness is the first thing he remembers. And then he's like, you know, my name is Jack Frost. How do I know that? The moon told me so. But that's all he ever told me. Which I thought was, like, a pretty strong opening. I was like, huh. Pretty compelling writing, yeah.
Pretty metal line, IMO.
Yeah, very good. So we get this introduction to Jack, and, you know, from there, we know he goes into town to, like, talk to people, and people start, like, they can't hear him. They walk right through him. He's a ghost. So, like, that's his whole thing. He wants people to see him. He wants to connect to people. But yeah, he's a ghost, basically.
Audience, put a fucking pin in that. We'll come back to it.
Okay. So then 300 years late pass, basically, and we get a cut to Santa's workshop. Santa, AKA North, is, like, doing some, like, train enthusiast sculpting with, like, ice trains. That's very fun. But, like, he has this, this globe, and it starts to, like, you know, it shows all the location of all the children in the world or whatever. And then, like, a big, like, dark shadow falls over it, and it looks like the boogeyman, whose name is Pitch Black. And he's like, "Oh, that's a bad sign. I'm gonna summon the Avengers." And he sets out a call. The Aurora goes out, and he summons the rest of the Guardians. So I get the Easter Bunny, right? That makes sense as a parallel to Christmas. But the Tooth Fairy and the Sandman are also part of this, like, this quad, right? We get Tooth, the Tooth Fairy, who you marked in your notes is like a is like hummingbird designed, which is a very interesting choice. So I think you're right. I think that's a much more interesting take on the Tooth Fairy than just, like, a fairy with, like, a crown and a wand, right? Sandy, which, like, is very strange. I don't think of the Sandman as, like, on the same tier as a Santa Claus or Easter Bunny in that way. I thought it was very strange that Sandy was included in this. I like Sandy. I think of all the Guardians, the Sandman's my favorite. Weird choice. But he's basically, like, a golden dust guy who doesn't speak and just, like, uses his sand to make little pictures. He's fun.
He is. He's very cute. I mean, I guess by that logic, do you think that the boogeyman is on the same tier as the Easter Bunny and Santa?
I do. You know, I think that, like, you know, you would call something that's supposed to frighten you a boogeyman, right? Like, you call that, that's like a noun that is used in English to describe, you know, something that is being used as a way to, like, create fear, right? Calling something a boogeyman is not unusual. But, like, you wouldn't say, oh, and this is, you know, like, and then the Tooth Fairy. Like, I don't know. Actually, The Rock has been the Tooth Fairy before. So, I don't know. It's... I guess if you're going to do this, there, you know, I guess I'm just surprised the Leprechaun wasn't in here, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, well, I think St. Patrick's
that
Day.
Joke.
Yes, they do. They're like, oh, yeah, let's get the Leprechaun in here. But yeah, I just feel like in American audiences, the Sandman is just a very strange choice.
Strange, but like you said, he whips ass. So I think he earns his place.
Right. No, absolutely. And listen, American Gods prominently features the Sandman, so you know what? I guess I have egg on my face. Do you want to you want to talk about the Easter Bunny?
I have nothing to say about the Easter
Don't
Bunny.
You?
I don't.
That's interesting.
What are you alluding to?
Oh, let me just open up Layla's notes here. Easter Bunny in this, played by Hugh Jackman, is explicitly Australian. I think it's very silly, but fun. And like he actually uses boomerangs as his weapons, which is a very funny choice that Hugh Jackman's like, I don't care that this is a primarily American audience. I am just going to be in Australia the whole time. Shout outs to Mr. Jackman.
Friend of the show, Mr. Hugh Jackman, who is featured in many, many, many of our episodes.
Yes. Friend of the pod of, you know, come on to Mortified anytime, Mr. Jackman. You're always welcome. Absolutely. Let me just read Layla's notes. Brackets, me sitting back in my chair, hands steepled, and brackets. Am I hot for this rabbit? quote, look, mate, I'm dealing with perishables, end quote. Yeah, I'm hot for this rabbit. He's jacked and has anxiety.
Listen. He's jacked, nervous, and organized. And if that's you, 716
mortifiedpod@gmail.com because that number is gonna get bleeped out. I know that. But.
Yeah, absolutely. man. The rabbit's hot. I don't know what you want from me.
I just, Layla, we have this conversation about once every 3 months I'm mortified. I think you could do better than the Easter Bunny.
Than Hugh Jackman?
Listen, Hugh Jackman.
The Australian.
Hugh Jackman.
He's 6'1", a master of Tai Chi.
Hugh Jackman's not the Easter Bunny, though. Listen, we are a pro furry podcast. Don't get me wrong. But so he literally does the DreamWorks face in this film, and I think
and
you can do better.
Fine. I can overlook that. If he can overlook the fact that I hate carrots, I can overlook that facial expression.
All right. I'll reach out to Mr. Jackman's agent with this clip, and we'll see if we can't get you at least a date. Yeah, basically, you know, they summon all the Guardians together. And they're all just like, you know, like, oh yeah, the boogeyman, we defeated him 300 years ago, which is interesting. Weird bit of world building that really doesn't come back up. But like they're like, okay, apparently the Man of the Moon, who, as you've pointed out in your notes, is the Nick Fury who like assembles them all and directs them. They call him Manny, which is very stupid. But they're like, yeah, Manny wants us to choose a new guardian. And apparently it's Jack Frost, so they kidnap Jack Frost, which is very funny.
Just like the opening of Cats, put it in a sack and toss it into the movie.
Listen, I think that's a pretty expedient and fun way to get your, you know, point of view protagonist into the narrative is just to have them thrown into a sack. It's good. But yeah, we kind of get this bit where Jack is like shown to be a good guy because he's like playing with kids, even though they can't see him. He is like creating a snow day and starting snowball fights. And like, you know, there's a bit where there's this kid named Jamie is like on a sled and Jack is like helping guide him around the city. He uses his snow powers to create like little, you know, tracks, right? He's sliding all around. And that's like, you know, that's how we see that Jack is like a cool guy that loves kids. So anyway, we'll come back to Jamie in a bit. But basically, yeah, Jack shows up at the North Pole He has some beef with the Easter Bunny because he like caused a blizzard in 1968 and it like ruined Easter. And so Hugh Jackman's mad about that. At one point, Jack Frost does call him a kangaroo, which I feel like is a slur. I don't think he should have said that. I think that was out of line.
It does feel like it, doesn't it, in the moment?
It's like, hey, buddy, wow. But yeah, basically, Jack's like, oh, I don't want to do this. This seems, your jobs seem like they suck, and I don't get the recognition that I deserve, so I don't want to be a part of this. But then they discover that Pitch Black has created an army of nightmares. Basically, he has corrupted the Sandman's dreams and turned them into, like, evil black horses, which is cool, with red eyes. And they like attack the Tooth Fairy Fortress, basically. So the Tooth Fairy's like little agents are all like little mini hummingbirds. She calls them baby teeth. They're really cute. But yeah, basically he kidnaps them all, the boogeyman does, in order to prevent people from believing in the Tooth Fairy. Because if people believe in you, that's how you get your power. So once the kids wake up and they're like, oh, my tooth are still under my pillow, like that's, I guess the Tooth Fairy is not real, then the Tooth Fairy starts losing her power, which is hard. And they're like, okay, so what we got to do instead is actually go and collect those teeth before, all the other kids wake up. So they start doing that. And that's like a fun sequence that, like, you know, I don't think it does anything, you know, narrative wise, you know, actually it might, because it kind of shows that, like, it shows the characters having fun together, right? And that is not nothing, right? It is important to show characters. Oh, go ahead.
I was just gonna say that is something distinctly missing from the Avengers, actually. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like the Avengers, at least later iterations of the Avengers, took itself so seriously, and like, it's nice to see characters goofing off.
Yeah, you know, not to get two on the Avengers track, but like, that's the thing about Age of Ultron, which was, you know, widely panned as a movie. I liked it a decent amount, but like, there's a bit in the beginning of that show which shows the Avengers like hanging out at a party at the Avengers Tower, and like, that's the best part of that movie, because it does just show them like being normal people and like chilling and like dicking around. And like, yeah, I think that's kind of, this kind of serves a similar purpose, where they're like, you know, they're all like collecting the bags of teeth, which is also a very funny thing to do. The teeth imagery in this movie is very funny. There's a bit where the Tooth Fairy tries to like ply a child by talking about how much she loves her bloody tooth, and the child's like, "Hey, what the fuck is wrong with you?"
Starts screaming. Yeah, Jamie's little sister screaming, yeah, and crying. Well, it also is like, it's a bit of friendly competition. It shows their relationships to each other, mm-hmm, lets them like flex their powers a little bit. It's fun. It's a fun way to do that. And then it leads to Jamie, right?
Right. Then you get to Jamie. Jamie's sister falls into a portal. And like, you know, she ends up on Easter Island, I believe, is what the Easter Bunny's like fortress is supposed to be.
That is what the implication is with the stone eggs.
Yes. Yeah. Hysterical. But like, yeah, Jamie briefly sees all the Guardians, and he's already like a cryptozoology guy. And he's like a 10-year-old kid, basically. But he's like, oh yeah, I see Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy and the Sandman. This is all great. He's so excited, and that like strengthens his belief. Is this the part where the Sandman is killed?
Yes, because what happens is, they all start getting into like a funny argument. The dog goes after the Easter Bunny. Mm-hmm. Also, shout out Greyhound representation in this fucking movie. Usually it's only golden retrievers in kids movies. I'm glad they got a skinny fucking dog in there. Mm-hmm. So there's a Greyhound, it goes after the bunny. And while they're doing that, the Sandman is like trying to knock out the dog and the kid so that they go to sleep and the Guardians can leave, but he ends up knocking out everybody, yes, except him and Jack.
Right.
And then they go chasing after Pitch.
Right. And at that point, like, Jack does a cool like snow attack that does like show how strong he is. But in the process, the Sandman is like corrupted by Pitch and seemingly dies. And they like fully have a funeral for him, which is like, wow, okay, pretty heavy choice, but like, you know, it kind of, you know, at least this movie is like trying to set stakes, whereas in The Lorax, I don't think there was any stakes the entire time, except for like Aloysius, who like was just being like kind of generically threatening. Like he didn't, but there was no like actual stakes for Ted in that movie. Whereas this one, it's like, oh yeah, you could be killed. You could just be flat out murdered in this world. Yeah.
You could just straight that. I love the funeral sequence. So the fun thing about Santa's Workshop is that the elves don't make the toys. The Yeti do.
Yes.
There's one sight gag with a Yeti who is painting. And then every time he finishes, somebody walks past says, I hate it. Paint it the opposite color.
Right. Right.
Great Yeti. But the little elves during that funeral, I just really like the use of them with the little, they look like little gnomes. They're tiny.
Right.
And they have giant bells on their hats. And I just really like the use of them, like kind of subbing in for church bells during the funeral.
Mm-hmm.
Where they would just kind of like sway and make the bell sound. It was nice. It was a cool use of the setting.
Yeah. Yeah. It was cool. But yeah, then they're like, okay, Easter's like tomorrow or whatever. So they have to like help the Easter Bunny get all the Easter eggs painted. They find a Jamie's sister who has like fallen into a portal there. And they like kind of, that kind of shows how Jack is like good with kids. And they're like, oh, Jack's actually a good guy. Here at some point, she explains, the Tooth Fairy explains that memories are kept in baby teeth. So everybody in the world's baby teeth that she has, like she can find their most important memories, including Jack's. And Jack doesn't have his memory of his like previous life before he was Jack Frost. So Jack's really motivated by that. There's a fun sequence where they have to paint the eggs. But then he like hears like somebody calling his name. He like follows the sound, or he ends up in Pitch Black's like dungeon where he's keeping all the little teeth.
Yeah, he goes to drop off the little sister.
Right.
And on his way back is where he gets detoured.
Right. And like, you know, this is a thing that happens in many movies, but basically it's just like, oh, this is where the villain makes it seem like you were on his side, kind of, or whatever reason. Basically he like Pitch Black is like, hey, you know, I'm sort of like you, and you know, here's the memories that you have. And you know, maybe you know, maybe we're not so different, you and I. It's not exactly that, but I got that feeling certainly. And then when Jack returns, this is the actual important thing, which is that the nightmares just came and destroyed all the eggs. And then they're like, "Wow, where were you, Jack? I can't believe you weren't here to help us. Oh, you're with Pitch. Well, I guess fuck you then." It's a nothing sequence. I think it's like just a very silly, like convenient way to like bring Jack to his, you know, lowest point, right? If this movie very, very narrowly maps onto like a Save the Cat, Kick the Dog story structure. So like, you know, it's fine. I get why they're doing it, but I didn't like it very much.
I think they could have, yeah. So there's two edits I would like to suggest, and I'll suggest my first one here. Instead of having them get mad, I don't think Jack should have gone back to them. I think he should have, because he ends up in the tunnel with all the eggshells. I think from there, he just goes away.
Right.
You know, from there, he feels like a failure and he fucks off and goes to that like tundra where he ends up.
Right.
And the guardians can stay looking for him. And there they have a reason to be upset that he abandoned them, right? Instead of like, oh, you got held up for 5 minutes looking for your own memories and now we're mad at you, right?
Right. No,
that's edit number one.
That's much better. I think that's an easy thing to do, and actually like makes it a little bit more compelling. But yeah, he goes to the Arctic, I guess. He's confronted by Pitch, who breaks his cool staff, which doesn't really matter. He chucks one of the baby teeth into the abyss with him, with Jack, which is very funny. But then,
I love the baby teeth. They're so cute.
Yeah, they're great. But yeah, he gets his memory back and he sees, you know, what happened with him was that he was a young boy in presumably the 1700s, who fell through the ice trying to save his sister. And you know, he drowned and that's how he became Jack Frost. And he's like, oh, okay, that's who I am. That's who I was. You know, this is why I'm good with kids, etc. And that gives him the strength to, you know, be who he is. There's a bit earlier where Santa Claus is like, you got to find your center. And this is the moment where it's like, okay, this is my center, is helping people be brave and have fun. And, you know, I'm a good guy, even though I couldn't remember that was my center in the first place. You know, it's a completely fine, like, redemption arc sort of deal.
And here's where I would like to make edit number two.
Mm-hmm.
So let's address the pin from the beginning, where he goes back to the village. He wakes up under the moon, goes back to the village, and people are walking through him. 30 seconds, DreamWorks. Barely that. What I would have liked to see is his little sister. So he doesn't have his memories. He doesn't know it's his little sister. I would have liked to see his little sister fucking sobbing in a corner somewhere because she just watched her brother fucking die.
Mm-hmm.
And him, like, even though he doesn't know it's his sister, being compelled to go over there and cheer her up, even though she cannot see him or know him or anything. That, I think, would give him the motivation and enough reward structure to be like, okay, even if they can't see me, I can help these kids and I can, like, make them laugh at least. And then maybe someday they'll see me, right?
Right.
I think that would give him enough driving force. Because one of the things I didn't really get was, like, Jack has this reputation for, like, kind of ruining everything. And he likes to make kids laugh, but he's not on board with the Guardians. And it's all just kind of, like, mushy. And I never really understood why he felt compelled to, like, be around the kids if they can't see him.
Sure.
But, like, just that little bit of extra, like, oomph. And then tying it back together in the flashback where it's like, oh, shit, that was his little sister. Watched him die. I think that would have been...
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that would be a little bit stronger, help the narrative stick together a little bit better. But yeah, you know, after he recovers his memories, he fuses his stick back together, gets his powers back, and they go to find Jamie, who is the last kid in the world who believes in the Guardians. And he and the Guardians have to turn, you know, have one last final defense of Jamie in order to, save the world from darkness. It's at this point we reveal that because the Easter bit failed so hard, Hugh Jackman he used to be like 6'1", enormous jackrabbit. Now he's just a little bunny.
He's just a little cute, fluffy bunny.
He's great. He's so mad about it. It's awesome. It's really fun. They have like a big fight sequence. Jamie gets all his friends to believe in the Guardians too. After Jack takes the first step, Jamie is the first kid who can actually see Jack, and he's like, oh wow, you're real. All the children come together, and through the power of their mutual belief in legends and shit, they're able to destroy the Sandman does come back to kind of deal the final blow. And that's pretty much how the movie ends, I think.
The Sandman, we should point out, his weapons are cool sand whips.
Yeah.
It fucking owns.
Yeah, he is very much doing a Gaara from Naruto, but like with golden dream sand. It's very cool.
It's sick. The scene where Jack gets Jamie to believe again, so Alexander Desplat does the soundtrack, is a pretty prolific film composer. And I love Alexander Desplat. And the song that plays underneath is called Jamie Believes. And that song makes me cry every single time I listen to it. So I can't listen to it. It's just beautiful. This movie has like a lovely little 5-note leitmotif that expands into a 9-note theme for the Guardians and for Jamie. It's just really good. It's a good soundtrack. Kids movies sometimes have great soundtracks.
Yeah.
If you like soundtracks, go listen to this one. It rules.
Yeah, I definitely think this movie was better than it had any right to be. There's definitely bits in the movie that I thought, you know, dragged or could have been edited better. But on the whole, you know, I liked this movie a lot better than The Lorax, and I thought it was at least trying something more interesting.
I love this movie. Like, hands down, I haven't watched it in a long time. I'm glad we got to revisit it today. I think it's fun. It's trying something. I really like the characters. I thought all the voice actors, even though they're, like, you know, famous screen actors, I thought did a really great job. Hugh Jackman did great. Alec Baldwin, a good performer despite his issues.
Mm-hmm.
Jude Law as Pitch.
Very good.
Cunty as hell.
Yep. You'd love to see it.
Jude Law, love Stefan. Isla Fisher is the Tooth Fairy. Like, just really good vocal performances, and the animation was great, and the particle effects, both for the Sandman and for Pitch, just really beautiful. I went and saw Elemental when it was in theaters, because I had a coupon, and I was like, well, I might as well go see it. And my beef with Elemental is that it's a completely fine movie, but it's literally made to be a tech showcase. Mm-hmm. And in both The Lorax and this, you can tell there's things in the tech they're trying out. Like with the Lorax, it was very much the fur, right?
And right. The truffula trees, right?
Yeah, you could tell it was like they were really playing with that. And then in Rise of the Guardians, they were like really going all in on particle tech. I really kind of miss watching something use the story as a vehicle for the tech rather than what Elemental did, which was make up a story in order to showcase tech.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's a thing. I wonder if there's in future Mortifieds will cover Pixar, because I do think that Pixar, at least in like the 2000s to like 2000 to 2010, I want to say, whenever Up was shown, right? I think Pixar is very able to create emotional like narratives and plots in a way that like a lot of other kids' movies just aren't. And I'm not sure exactly why they are, but like I do kind of watching these two did make me kind of wish that somebody in the writer's room had wanted to like make a little bit heavier swings here, because I think there could have been a little bit more narrative heft for both of these movies. But even if they are made for kids, I think kids deserve to have movies that are impactful.
Kids do, and we've said this a bunch of times before. I think for Mortified, well, we can do a little bit of what we usually do behind the scenes on air just for funsies. Mm-hmm. I think it would be fun. I think what we're learning over these, like, what, 5 years that we've been doing this fucking podcast?
Yeah, pretty much. This is season 5.
This is insane. It's the podcast's birthday in a couple of months, which is, it'll be its 4th birthday. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're headed into year 5. That's crazy. I think for Mortified, what I've seen kind of over time is that we do really well with content in terms of kids content made more for like teens. Mm-hmm. And when we get into content made for kids, I feel like it loses us.
It definitely loses me.
It loses me for sure. Because I think the thing with content for kids, like why we wouldn't maybe be able to get into Minions lore or anything like that too much, is that so much of it is just like, look at the bright color, look at this move, right, look at this go, right. Oh, action sequence. Mm-hmm. And then it's not built for the plot to be thought about.
Right.
And you can get away with that more in like for media for really, really young kids. But for teens, there's some heavier swings. So I think we do better there.
Yeah.
I'd be really interested in looking at some older Pixar stuff, like maybe revisiting A Bug's Life.
I know that Ladybug is transphobic, so like I don't know that how well that aged, but I'm still willing to give it a shot.
The Ladybug is transphobic but overcomes his transphobia to support his friend.
Oh, okay, well maybe yeah. We'll check that out.
I love A Bug's Life. There's some flicks we could get into for sure-sies. But yeah, I'm glad you had fun with Rise of the Guardians, and I'm glad you got some historical context for the Lorax.
Yes, no, this is a really, I'm learning constantly, and this is a really important and educational episode for me. But yeah, I do want to, as we are, winding down our episode, I do want to, for our marketing minute, pitch you on, okay. We know that they did the trilogy, Horton Hears a Who, Cat in the Hat, and Lorax. Correct. But what I'm thinking of, as since there's no hint that studios are going to, stop remaking shit for the next several years, I'm wondering if we here at Mortified Inc. Could probably like be the directors, producers, writers for the next Dr. Seuss adaptation. I don't know if you have like a particular Dr. Seuss book that you think probably could go through like a new adaptation, but I have a couple that I'd like to pitch you on.
Please pitch me, because I guess Layla Lore reveal, I've never read a Dr. Seuss book.
Oh, interesting. Okay, good. So first, Yertle the Turtle. Have you ever heard of Yertle the Turtle?
I've not heard of any of the three that are on this
list. Okay, good. So Yertle the Turtle is a little bit about like a turtle who like, tries to put himself above everybody else, like literally making a tower of turtles beneath him. Broadly read as like an analogy for like Adolf Hitler's rise to power and how he like, like for kids though, right? Like, oh, this is a bully who put himself above everybody else. I think we could probably do a pretty gritty reboot, set this in, 1930s Germany right?
Uh-huh.
And just do like,
so go really direct,
go full historical docudrama. You know how like Wicked is coming out, right? And Wicked is trying to do like the animal racism bit, but like we just fully just put turtle racism in 1930s Germany. I think we can just like go direct historical analogy, go do the mouse thing, right? I think we could absolutely to do that and try to like really win. That's Oscar bait.
I have something cooking in my head,
mm-hmm.
which is that if we do this, we have to cameo Fowler in his RAF days from Chicken
Run.
Oh
yeah, no, absolutely. He'll be in there. He'll be like, yeah, there'll be like a couple seconds shot where like a chicken will fly over, you know, a building, right? And it'll have the Fowler voice actor, absolutely. There's another one though. Go ahead.
Okay. I was just gonna say Ardman, hit us up.
Yeah, Ardman, absolutely. Yeah, mortifiedpod@gmail.com. There's the Barbie movie came out last year, broadly successful. People thought it was pretty impactful all the way. I think to ride this feminism train, we could talk about Hop on Pop. Hop on Pop is a story about some weird creatures. One of them is a dad, and you kind of have to, and they're talking about jumping on this guy, right? And I think we could blow this out into an allegory for destroying the patriarchy. Okay. And I think that as long as we get like a Margot Robbie or a Zoe Deschanel, Sydney Sweeney, right, any conventionally attractive white woman to lead it, I think we could absolutely destroy the patriarchy with Hop on Pop.
Uh-huh. Yes, the text, I'm looking these up as you're as you're talking about them. And so the basis of this movie, the text reads, "Hop Pop, we like to hop. We like to hop on top of Pop.
Mm-hmm.
Stop. You must not hop on Pop."
Right. And like this is great. You know, you can read that so many ways, right? We like to hop on top of Pop, right? That's about the sexual subjugation of women historically, and the ways in which that men are the only ways who've actually controlled sexual value because of their position in society, right? You can talk about, the ways in which women have to use their collective power to subvert those power structures to destroy the patriarchy, right? There's a lot of really important and deep reads you could make on Hop on Pop, I think. Now I can lick 30 tigers today. This one's a bit of a stretch. Because
where's
this
the cat
is
in the hat here?
This is a story about a boy who claims he can defeat 30 tigers in combat, but as he continues to talk about them, he makes excuses for why he can't fight all 30 of them, until at the end he doesn't have to fight any of them. What I am proposing is that we do not use the term lick to mean a fight, and we just turn this movie into furry bait.
Okay. So you did say boy. What I am seeing is the cat in the hat.
Wait, the cat in the hat's in this one?
I'm going to hold my phone up to my webcam.
That's the cat in the hat. That's the hat. That's that he wears.
And the tail and the bow tie.
Oh, man.
So that's already furry bait. Are you suggesting we have Jim Carrey lick tigers?
Yeah, but they have to be like sexy anthropomorphic Tony the Tigers.
Like Tony.
Yes. Thank you for getting there at the same time as I did.
Of course.
Yeah, and I mean, like, that's just, we don't really have to write a script for that. We just have to animate it. Yeah, go ahead.
Can I make a suggestion?
Mm-hmm.
We could do all three.
Whoa, okay.
30. Listen, hear me out. 30 minutes each, we do a collection.
Oh.
An anthology. And we just call it And Other Stories, because that's what these are.
Right.
I can lick 30 tigers today and other stories.
Oh.
We do 30 minutes each. And then we can take some really big swings.
Right. Absolutely.
And make some impact.
Right. We can have them all be tonally different, and it makes sense. Oh, my God. That would be really good.
Yes.
And we could get different studios to do each one.
Oh my God, kind of like the Star Wars
right
thing.
Exactly, that's what I'm thinking. Oh my God,
so 30 tigers today has to go to Trigger.
Yeah, because of how horny they are.
Some, well, yeah, but also like if you've ever seen BNA, they can draw a hot wolf.
That's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. we did see BNA. I believe we covered it
we
on
did.
This podcast.
I forgot we watched the first program.
We've been
yeah,
doing
good,
this for 5 years. Yeah.
Good anime. And then we've already talked about Girdle the Turtle needs to be Aardman, right, mm-hmm. for that Chicken Run tie-in.
Right.
What about Hop on Pop?
What is the most pop culture feminism animation studio out there?
I'm not sure that exists.
That's probably true.
I'm trying to think. Maybe something French.
Ooh.
Maybe we go to France for this one.
Who are the people who did Code Lyoko?
Anti-Films. No, I think Anti-Films still exists. Hold on.
Anti-Films.
Oops.
Rip. Moonscoop now. But yes, 2014. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Moonscoop, call us.
Yeah. We'll get the band back together. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Listen. Either that or the people who did, Miraculous Ladybug.
Oh, that would be good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if any of you,
that's
all,
our pitch.
Yeah. The Dr. Geisel Estate. If y'all wanna wanna have us write and produce that, hit us up at mortifiedpod@gmail.com. But yeah, when we are not again pitching some of the most stunning, emotional, and cinematically groundbreaking short films that anyone has ever conceived of, Layla. Where else can we be found on the internet?
You can find me at LEYLSES on Blue Sky and on Tumblr. I think I finally achieved my goal of being more boring online than I am in real life. I don't post much, but I am hoping that this summer finally, I know I've been saying this for years, but I'm hoping this summer finally my schedule evens out and I can get back to some of my creative pursuits.
Yeah.
But that's kind of where I'm at. Aaron, at this point, your world-changing video essay will have come out.
Yes. At this point, by the time you're hearing this, the most important video essay in RPG history, aka Hamlet, RPGs, and the Human Condition, which is an April Fool's Day joke about the one-word RPG, We Are But Worms, and Hamlet, will be out. I think it's actually a very fun essay. Caro Assertion, a renowned game designer, helped me write it, and I'm really excited for folks to watch it tomorrow. My ARG is concluding today, so if you've been playing along with that, I hope you found all my clues, Mr. Policeman. But yeah, you can find my videos on Tabletop Games at AA Voight on YouTube. And you can find me on Blue Sky at AA Voight, on Monster Factory Fanfic on Tumblr, and Aaron SXL on Twitter, unfortunately. Our theme song is Obsolete by Keshko from the album Filmmakers Reference Kit, Volume 2. You can find more of their music at keshko.bandcamp.com. Layla, how do we close out this great and groundbreaking episode?
Thank God that this podcast is now over, because now there will be nothing but fear and darkness and me.
Amen. We'll see you all next time.
Bye-bye.